Chapter 2. Greetings to the Future. After Winston had breathed deeply to make himself calmer, then carefully opened the door, he quickly relaxed. A woman with a tired face and thin grey-brown hair stood there.
"Oh, comrade,"
she said in a tiny, worried voice,
"could you look at our kitchen sink? The water won't go down. And..."
Her voice became quieter and quieter till she stopped speaking completely. It was Mrs. Parsons, who lived on the same floor as Winston. She was about 30, but she looked much older. Winston was not surprised by her visit. The flats in Victory House were old and falling to pieces. Ceilings, walls, and water pipes often had holes in them, and the heating did not work very well. Flats were never repaired for them, so people repaired their own, and each other's if they could.
"Tom would do it if he was at home," said Mrs. Parsons, as Winston followed her along the corridor to her flat. Tom, her husband, a worker at Minnie True with Winston, was the kind of stupid person who the party liked. He never asked questions. The Parsons had two children, so their flat was bigger than Winston's. On the way to the kitchen, Winston saw on the walls the banners of the Spies, an organisation which all children belonged to, as well as a poster of Big Brother. He could hear military music from the telescreen in the living room as they passed it, and he could also hear someone trying to play the music on a comb and paper. "It's the children," said Mrs. Parsons nervously. "They haven't been out today, so they..."
She always talked quietly, and her sentences never really finished. However, Winston knew that almost all the parents in Oceania were afraid of their children. The Thought Police encouraged children to spy on their parents and report anything they did or said which was against party rules. The sink was filled with dirty green water, which smelled horribly of cabbage. Winston bent down to find where two pipes were joined beneath the sink. The movement made his back hurt.
"Have you got any tools I can use?" he asked.
"Tools?" she said. "Oh, I don't know. Perhaps the children..."
She wandered away and came back with a bag of tools, then wandered away again to the living room where the noise of the children was becoming even louder. Winston took apart the pipes and let the water out, removing a lot of horrible, smelly human hair. He cleaned his fingers as well as he could in cold water from the tap and went to the living room.
"Put your hands up!"
shouted a savage voice. A boy of 9 was pointing a toy gun at Winston. Behind him stood a small girl, about 2 years younger, who was doing the same thing with a piece of wood. Both of them were wearing the uniform of the Spies: blue shorts, grey shirts and red scarves.
"You're a thought criminal,"
screamed the boy.
"You're a Eurasian criminal. I'll shoot you. I'll vaporise you."
The boy and girl jumped around Winston, shouting,
"Thought criminal!"
The boy sounded so savage that Winston felt glad he was not holding a real gun. Mrs. Parsons looked nervously from Winston to the children and back again.
"They get so noisy," she said. "They're disappointed because they can't go to the hanging, you see. I'm too busy and Tom is at work, so..."
"Why can't we go to the hanging?"
shouted the boy.
"Want to see the hanging?"
screamed the little girl. Winston remembered that some Eurasian prisoners were going to be hanged in a park that evening. Children enjoyed watching these public hangings, which happened every month. He said goodbye to Mrs. Parsons and as he walked down the corridor, he felt a sharp pain as a stone hit the back of his neck. He turned round quickly, in time to see Mrs. Parsons dragging the boy back into the flat.
"Goldstein!"
the boy screamed at him. Winston saw the look of helpless fear on the mother's pale, tired face. Belonging to the spies made the children love the party and Big Brother more than their parents. The organisation was just a game to them, as they sang songs, shouted slogans, and marched with guns. But they became savage and learned to hate all the people who were called enemies of the party, like foreigners. They were praised and called child heroes in newspaper articles if they told the thought police when their parents had done something wrong. As soon as he was back in his own flat, Winston sat down in the alcove again and picked up his pen. But before he could continue writing, he suddenly thought about O'Brien again. About 7 years ago, Winston had had a dream. He was walking through a dark room when he heard a voice say quietly, "We shall meet in the place where there is no darkness." At the time, the words had not seemed important, but as the years had passed, he had become sure that it was O'Brien's voice which spoke. Winston was certain that there was a link between the two of them. He did not know whether they were friends or enemies, and it did not matter. "We shall meet in the place where there is no darkness," O'Brien had said, and Winston knew that in some way this would come true. Suddenly, loud music came from the telescreen, followed by a voice announcing a wonderful victory by Oceanian soldiers in South India. And there was bad news.
"And now, here is a news flash," said the voice. "The chocolate ration is being reduced from 30 grams to 20.
Then the Oceanian national anthem started to play very loudly. "Oceania, my dear land," it started, and Winston stood up, as he had to do whenever it was played. When the anthem had ended, he went back to the window. Far away, he heard a rocket bomb explode as it landed. About 20 or 30 of them landed on London every day. The past was dead, and he could not imagine the future. Would anyone ever remember a time before the party? Would the party last forever? He took a coin from his pocket and looked at the party slogans on one side and the head of Big Brother on the other. Even from the coin, the eyes were looking at him. He felt alone. Was there anyone on his side? The clocks struck 14, and Winston had to be back at work in the ministry by 14:30. But before he left, he added some more lines to his diary and felt less pessimistic. "Greetings to the future, to a time when thought is free, when men are different from each other and do not live alone. Greetings to a time when truth exists and cannot be changed." He was already dead, he thought, because he had started to explain his thoughts. Then he wrote, "Thought crime does not lead to death. Thought crime is death." Now he knew that he was a dead man, it was important to stay alive as long as possible. So, before he went back to work, he used a piece of rough brown soap to wash away the ink marks from the fingers that had held the pen.